Welcome to the Davey Tree Expert Company's podcast, Talking Trees. I'm your host, Doug Oster. Each week, our expert arborists share advice on seasonal tree care, how to make your trees thrive, arborists' favorite trees, and much, much more. Tune in every Thursday to learn more, because here at the Talking Trees podcast, we know trees are the answer. I'm joined today by Adam Baker. He's a research entomologist for the Davey Institute based in Kent, Ohio. And today we're talking all about caterpillars. And Adam, there's good caterpillars, bad caterpillars, and ugly caterpillars. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I think ugly is in the eye of the beholder. But we'll talk about certainly some interesting and eerie alien-like caterpillars today.
You know, those weird-looking ones I don't think are ugly at all. You know, as a home gardener, we see the tomato hornworm all the time, and many people think that one is ugly, but I think that is the coolest-looking caterpillar. So tree-wise, what is the one you hear about most of the time this time of the year?
Well, if we're talking about sort of the pests, the bad guys of the caterpillar world, we're generally talking about the, you know, 1 to 2 inch long fuzzy caterpillars, things like the spongy moth, which have been active in the last month or so. Looking forward towards the fall, we have things like fall webworm. We've got the eastern tent caterpillars and things like that. As far as some of our more charismatic type caterpillars and butterflies, we have things like the zebra swallowtail, which feed on our pawpaw trees. Things like our silk moths, like our luna moths, and our cercopia moths, which are feeding on things like ash and cherry and things like that. Yeah, so some of my favorites, like I mentioned before, with a zebra swallowtail, which this host plant is pawpaw. Things like the spice bush swallowtail, which feeds on spice bush and sassafras. What's kind of cool about that one is that in its first several larval instars, it mimics a bird dropping to avoid predation. And then their last couple instars are the ones that look like those little green snakes with the large yellow eyes. Really cool caterpillar to take a look at. And of course, our large silk moth caterpillars are always really fun to find. Things like luna moths that feed on hickory and walnuts, cercopias that feed on ash and cherry and poplar, and then the big hot dog sized hickory horn devil, or the royal walnut moth, which feeds, of course, on hickories, walnuts, ash, cherries, and the like.
So that hickory horn devil, is that one that can hurt you? Like if you were to grab it, or I have that wrong?
That one will not hurt you. It's always okay. A good idea to proceed with caution when it comes to handling caterpillars, especially the farther south you go. Some of them have what they call urticating hairs, which can poke you, sting you, cause some rashes. But the hickory horn devil is fairly safe to handle.
Okay, but it's scary looking, right? Like if you didn't know what it was, you wouldn't want to grab it. Is that right?
Certainly, it looks a little bit intimidating. Like I said, some of them, the later instars are about the size of a hot dog, get these large red-looking horn-type appendages on them. They almost remind you like one of those long Chinese dragons that you see in like in the parades and such.
So I have a lot of those trees that you're talking about. But I don't see much damage. Like, I've got an entire pawpaw forest. I'm going to have to go up there and look around. Is that the only host plant? Like is it the same way like a milkweed would be for a monarch? What is the caterpillar that likes the pawpaw?
So there's several different caterpillars that get on pawpaw. The zebra swallowtail was the one that I mentioned. It's not exclusive to pawpaw, but that's generally its preferred host plant. But also things like the eastern tiger swallowtails will use things like pawpaw, but also poplar and cherry. And a lot of the tree-related butterflies and moths often have a little bit wider host range than something like a monarch butterfly. Generally, some of our common deciduous trees, cherries, poplars, a lot of the things use oak as well.
So even though the caterpillar is feeding on the tree, the benefit is we get the beautiful butterfly, right?
I mean, from a human perspective, sure, being able to enjoy butterflies feeding on our nectar plants and our landscapes is absolutely one benefit. But also, you know, there's a reason why these pollinating insects have so many progeny, and that's because a lot of them are preyed upon. So on a sort of a different trophic level, you know, as adults, they act as pollinators and provide and facilitate reproduction of plants. But their larvae often act as a very important food source for things like birds and other arthropods. So they are very good for the environment on both the providing food for the food web and as well as creating food for the food web.
And then when you're thinking of caterpillars, well, I guess when I'm thinking of caterpillars, I'm thinking of homeowners looking up at a tree and seeing it being defoliated and freaking out. Are there caterpillars that do that?
Yeah, certainly. So a lot of the caterpillars that we perceive as beneficial, often their mothers lay a single egg and then disperse those eggs throughout the environment. So you really don't see that concentrated damage. The ones that tend to be pests are the moths generally that lay their eggs in clusters and create large aggregations of feeding. So a lot of the web making caterpillars are really the only ones that cause, you know, sort of that economic damage, as well as the spongy moth, which of course is an invasive species that can defoliate, you know, full forests in years where they have large enough populations. But on a regular cycle, our native insects, things like forest tent caterpillar, fall webworm, and eastern tent caterpillar, can sometimes reach population levels where they cause damage. So one sort of interesting story about a pest caterpillar causing unforeseen damage is in Kentucky a few years ago, where they had something called mare reproductive loss syndrome, where there was a bunch of cases where mares were losing their foals before they were born. And so the entomologists went to work at it, and that year there had been a very large population of eastern tent caterpillar, which of course loves to feed on things like black cherry, a very, very common hedgerow tree in Kentucky. And what they figured out was that all of those large aggregations were defoliating the black cherries and the hedgerows. They were crawling off of the trees and then moving to find another food source. And as they were moving through horse pastures, and the mares were eating the caterpillars, and those urticating hairs came off the caterpillars and caused problems in the reproductive system. So we're losing very, very valuable high stock horses to an exasperated population of eastern tent caterpillar.
So does bagworm come into this as caterpillars, or bagworm is something different?
Bagworm is definitely a caterpillar. That is one that I missed on my list. So thank you for for bringing that one up.
So explain what the bagworm is, what it looks like, and what we're supposed to do about it.
Yeah, so the bagworm is an interesting pest. They generally like to feed on things like conifers, but certainly you'll find them on birch and other type of species. And what they do that it's interesting is that they'll go around and collect material from their surrounding plants. They'll mix it with silk and create a bag-like structure in which they can live in. This protects them from predators. This protects them from parasitoids and the elements as well. And what's interesting about these is that the females are wingless and almost resemble a larva, even when they're an adult. So the females will feed closely around the bag, and at some point they will stay in the bag and create a pheromone in which the winged males can then locate them, and they will actually breed there and then create a bunch of eggs for the next season. After those are overwintered, those tiny caterpillars will emerge from the bags. They do what's called ballooning, where they'll create a thin line of silk. And because their body is so light, and because of that fine silk strand, they'll actually float off into the air like a balloon, finding new host sources in which they can feed.
So if we have those, what we identify as the bag on the tree, that's a bad thing, right? Or that's okay. Or it depends on how many are on there.
Sure. Generally, a couple bags probably aren't going to cause problems. But one thing you can do, especially if they're on plants that you've invested in your landscape and are part of your ornamental landscape, is you can simply start removing the bags by hand and discard those in, you know, a plastic bag or somewhere away from the plant material you're trying to protect. If they do get into bad enough situations and you do want to pursue treatment, you know, I always suggest using something like a natural derived pesticide, something like Bacillus thuringiensis or BT, which will only affect caterpillars and will not mess with all the natural enemies, the predators and parasitoids on your plants that are doing some pest control for you.
Well, that's an interesting point to, you know, basically target the pest with letting the whole cycle of nature continue. That's definitely a good thing. Now, how about fall webworm? You mentioned that, and I'm just guessing that's those ones I see, like, if I look in the forest in the trees, it looks like a big kind of webby nest. Is that a fall webworm?
Yeah, so fall webworm is going to be a smaller caterpillar with white hairs. And how you distinguish fall webworm, and there's a couple of them that are similar, things like mimosa webworm and such, they kind of behave the same way. And the one key thing here is that they build their webs at the tips of branches. And they're often quite smaller than things like the eastern tent caterpillar or the forest caterpillar. You know, the eastern tent caterpillar usually builds their nests in the fork of branches, whereas things like fall webworm will be at the tip of the branches. Oftentimes, there's not enough caterpillars to really cause cosmetic damage unless you have multiple nests per tree. And address something like these, you can also use something like BT, but you can also use something even easier like a pole pruner and just prune out those single nests and get those out of there if they are starting to cause some damage.
So as an entomologist, do you see this kind of trend that I think I see is that we're bug phobic, where in much of what you're talking about here, it is just the cycle of nature, and just seeing a bug or a fall webworm or something like that on your tree doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be treated.
Correct. I think there's certainly a change in culture here in the last several years where we're getting away from this, you know, completely clean aesthetic version of our outside landscape. We're moving into planting more native plants, more plants that are going to be less pest prone, things that have natural resistance to the natural diseases happening. And I think in this day and age that, you know, maybe seeing a few nibbles on your ornamental plants is a good thing, you know, because it says that your backyard isn't sterile, that it's providing, you know, ecological function to your landscape, where there's a full cycle going on from pollination to herbivory to the predator and parasitoid complexes in our backyards. So I think it's kind of exciting in a way that connects us to nature. Moving forward, I think we need to see a lot more of that.
Do you get a lot of questions from friends and neighbors and maybe even colleagues where they send you a picture of something that they're really afraid of and you tell them that's a firefly?
Yeah, if you have any interest in pursuing a career in entomology, you're going to feel like a cryptozoologist, because every day I get pictures from friends and family that are always blurry of some random arthropod in their yard. But it's a lot of fun. Oftentimes, people are pretty excited to hear all these very intricate and beautiful life history stories of these insects that they're just completely unaware of.
How did this become your thing? Tell me the journey about being an entomologist.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Southwest Michigan, and our backyard was essentially a bog. And so I spent most of my time out there catching tadpoles and turtles and water bugs and beetles and stuff like that. And so that sort of fostered my interest in nature. And always as a kid, I wanted to become a naturalist. Eventually, along the lines, was, you know, interest changed a little bit. And when I went to college, I was actually pursuing a degree in environmental literature and nature writing, at which point I took a few entomology classes and sort of changed my directory from there, where those were very interesting to me. So I got some jobs as an undergraduate looking at various entomological things. My first job there was looking at benthic invertebrates, where we did stream sampling to understand how dying hemlock in eastern Appalachia could influence the changes in stream diversity as those streams now transition to deciduous forests. After that, I took a job in a pollinator lab where we're doing putting together pollinator community data, looking at 75 woody ornamental species in our urban landscapes and trying to understand how attractive these plants were. And beyond that, I moved into a PhD position looking at monarch butterfly conservation using ecology-based theory to help design habitats and optimize the return and reward for creating these type of habitats, increasing the amount of egg laying going on while still maintaining the same predator predation levels.
So I want to go off topic a little bit here and start off with monarchs. In general, do we know how the monarch is doing?
Yeah, so we have a annual census that happens where Monarch Watch and others help with that effort, where essentially what they do is they use aerial photos of the overwintering grounds each year. There's about 12 discrete locations that they use every year where they congregate by the hundreds of thousands. And essentially, they measure the area occupied by monarch butterflies. So every year, we get a starting point for the population, which can be sort of an indicator for, you know, growing populations. But of course, the monarch butterfly fluctuates a lot in its population. So we have that starting point, but understanding it throughout the season, there's still a lot of things you can do. Various projects like Journey North, where you can report sightings of, you know, everything from the eggs to the adults to help track populations throughout. In general, the monarch butterfly is doing okay. It's not at the level that we want it to be. We want it to be sitting at that 6 hectare overwintering mark, which is, we believe, the area at which things like a devastating storm or an unknown disease or something that can hit them and they can still rebound. Right now, I think they're about 2.5 at the last reading. So we're a little bit a ways, but with all the programs to plant milkweed and all the monarch health stuff going on, I think there's hope.
And since I have such an expert in front of me, I've got to throw in something about spotted lanternfly, because on our side of the region, we are inundated with spotted lanternfly, and it is driving people crazy. Are you concerned about this? Have you seen it yet? Are you looking at what might be coming your way?
So you've got it a little bit worse than we do. We don't have it quite yet here in Northeast Ohio, but it's only a matter of time before it shows up here. I have some family that lives on the East Coast in Baltimore, and certainly it's all over out there. The silver lining with the spotted lanternfly is that it is moving a lot slower than the initial predictions, and it's causing a lot less overall tree death than they anticipated. It tends to target trees that are very, very vigorous and healthy. Unlike some other sucking insect pests that have a pump that can pull fluids out of the vascular system of the tree, the spotted lanternfly depends on the positive pressure of the tree to push sap into their feeding system. So I'm sure you've heard mention of them, you know, liking things like Tree of Heaven. Mm-hmm. And at first it was expected that that may be part of their life cycle, being as it is from the same region that they come from. But now it's more believed that just because the tree is so vigorous, it's targeted because of that reason, that feeding reason, and because it's so ubiquitous in these disturbed areas where, you know, the spotted lanternfly is also at.
Well, before I let you go, just tell me a little bit about what you get out of your job. What do you love about your job as an entomologist and, you know, helping people identify and deal with these caterpillars and other insects.
Sure. I mean, I think one of the most rewarding parts is how completely diverse the job is. You know, we're not just dealing with pests and solving problems on that. We're also dealing with solutions to mitigate risk to things like pollinators and mitigate risk to other natural insects. So one day we may be looking at, you know, for instance, one thing we're working on right now is we're creating clay caterpillar models that look like little monarchs, and we go pin them to plants all over the place, and then things attack them. And as they attack them, they leave indentions on the clay caterpillar. So then we can collect them back up. We can look at the indentions and we can assess what species of bird it was, whether it was a wasp. So cool things like that. The ecology, you know, ecology is this vast nebulous of connections that some of them that we can see, some of them are unforeseen. But it's the mystery of sort of getting involved with those ecological mysteries that make a really interesting job.
Adam, that was absolutely fascinating. I really appreciate your time, and I'm sure we'll talk again because I could go another hour with questions about insects. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Doug. I appreciate you having me on.
I hope you're enjoying listening to these podcasts as much as I'm enjoying hosting them. I learn something every time I talk to one of these experts. If you do like what you're hearing, do me a favor. Subscribe to the podcast so you'll never miss one of our Thursday Talking Trees podcasts from the Davy Tree Expert Company. I am your host, Doug Oster, and I'd love to hear from you. Send me an email to podcasts@davy.com. That's podcasts at davey.com. And as always, we'd like to remind you on the Talking Trees podcast, trees are the answer.